What's up? What's up? What's up, dude? It's me. I'm in a hotel in Moab, Utah. Up a canyon with no service, just Wi-Fi. Been here for about 10 days now. Life's good, man. I got this view out my back window. I got this little back patio area with just this amazing view of the Colorado River and these giant red rocks, and it's cool, man. It's cool. So if the sound is a little weird this week, bear with me, okay? I was expecting to be here last week. So last week we didn't have a podcast because I was like, I'm going to be out of town shooting this movie. I kind of had to leave in a hurry because they bumped up my shooting dates. They moved it up in the schedule, so I had to pack up real quick and leave. And I chose to bring all of my film equipment, like my lights and stuff with me instead of my audio equipment. But my buddy here, who's in the movie as well, had a Yeti USB mic. And they wound up keeping me here another week. I was supposed to be here for a week, go back to LA for 10 days, then come back for another week. They decided to just keep me here for the duration. So I was like, well, I can't have no podcast for 3 weeks straight. So I went ahead and did an episode, and I'm not in the Blanket Fort recording studio. We don't have the sound panels on the walls. I'm not talking into a Shure SM7B. I'm talking into a little Yeti microphone, and it's okay. But you know, that's why maybe the sound's going to be a little bit this week, but that's all right. Life's good, dude. Life's really good. What movie, you ask? I know you're asking. You're out there going, what? You're in Moab shooting a movie? What are you shooting, Austin? Well, all right. You know, look, I'm going to tell you, but be cool about it. Okay. Don't be like, oh, wow, you're bragging, because like you're the one who's asking. You're sitting there listening to the podcast going, I want to know what movie you're shooting. And then I'm going to tell you, and don't be like, oh, but I'm also not going to be like, it, whatever, you know, it's fine. Sometimes I work with big celebrities on movies or TV shows, and they'll do this thing where they'll be like, oh, I was making this movie, it's called, and they'll say the name of it, and you're like, yeah, I know what that is, and I know you were in that. It's a very famous movie. But they'll kind of just try to downplay it. Be like, oh, you know, I was shooting this movie, it was called X-Men Days of Future Past. And you're like, yeah, it's one of the X-Men movies, you were in that, you were Cyclops in that movie, I remember. I was there, I saw it. You don't need to act like it's like a community theater production that you did of like a play by a local playwright. You wouldn't have heard of it. It was this little movie called Titanic. It was an indie director named James Cameron that I was in. But you know, a few of us got together and put it together. It was just a little $250 million tryst that we did. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I'm doing just because right now life is cool. All right. I'm in my hotel room with my beautiful view. The other day I go to set for the first time. And if you don't know any of these people, if I'm saying these names and you're like, who, look them up and you'll be like, oh, okay. But I walk in to do my first scene in this movie. It's a Western. That's why we're out in the desert. And I got my mustache rocking, I got dirt all over my face, cowboy hat pulled down. I'm feeling like a mean guy, like an old Western settler who's seen some shit, who's got a gun on his hip and he's used it. Okay? He's watched a lot of people die. And walk on set for rehearsal. This is a big movie. This is like it's a big like $130 million movie. And I walk into this room where we're going to be doing this scene, and we're breaking down the scene. And in the room, this is everyone that's in the room. Danny Houston, look him up. Will Patton, look him up. Michael Rooker, look him up. Okay. Luke Wilson, you know Luke Wilson? You know Richie Tenenbaum, The Family Stone, Idiocracy? The Godfather from old school, Luke Wilson, brother of Owen, the Wilson brothers. And, oh, no big deal. Who's directing the scene? Kevin Costner. You ever heard of him? Huh? Huh? And me. That's who's in the room. Danny Houston, Will Patton, Michael Rooker, Luke Wilson, Kevin Costner, and moi. Get out of here. What are you, what kind of universe, huh? I don't know how I was in the room, but I was. And I think I'm telling you this right now because there's a lot in this episode, in this conversation that you're about to listen to about impermanence and about learning to appreciate impermanence and just be with impermanence and constantly just notice these fleeting, impermanent, transient moments in your life, whether they're uncomfortable and painful or whether they're really, really cool. So even an experience like this, I tell you it with the knowledge that I'm like, this is just right now in my life. This is just a moment in my life. It's one little teeny moment of my life. A few weeks in the desert with these people that I've been watching in movies my entire life. And for a few weeks, I'm going to be doing the job with them. I'm going to be cutting it up and I'm going to be talking, breaking down scenes, breaking down dialogue, figuring out what the best beats are emotionally. We're going to be doing the job together for a few weeks, and it's mostly I'm just enjoying the scenery and trying to stay level-headed and cool, knowing that this is an impermanent, beautiful little moment in my life and in my journey, my up and down journey as an actor, my up and down journey as an entertainer. For a few weeks right now, I get to have a cool little ride with people who have been very successful in this industry and people who I really admire, and you know, it's cool, man, and it's good. And I do a lot of complaining on this show. I do a lot of talking about the things that are vexing me. Do a lot of talking about my anxiety, my depression, my sadness, all that stuff. Because I want to keep it real with you. But I also want to keep it real with you about the good stuff. Okay? I want to keep it real with you about the fact that, like, sometimes my life rips, dude. Sometimes my life really rips. And right now it's good. I'm getting a movie star. I'm being a movie star, man. I'm hanging out in a nice room on the Colorado River with a beautiful view, shooting a big movie. All right? And I'm still coming to you with the podcast because I love you, dude. I'm not going to do 3 weeks off. I'm going to bring you a little Yeti microphone, kind of bad audio quality episode of the show. Hey, we're going to get into this conversation with Ginny here, but I thought before we do, we could do a little review. Oh yeah, dude, it's Review the Review. It's where you go to Apple Podcasts and you give this show a 5-star rating and then you write a review and I read it on the show and I review it back, okay? I review your review back, but you gotta give 5 stars. 5 stars or I won't read it. Them's the rules, all right? 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, write a review. You can write anything, any old thing you want, and I'll read it and I'll review you back. It works like this, our first review. Says, Austin is great, well worth the listen. That's the title of the review. This is from Brain Power, who says, he is a very sincere, caring, and smart individual, open and honest about his own struggles in life, but never looks for pity. We learn about ourselves through others, and he's got a lot to offer. Talented musician, too. Funny TikTok, so check that out, too. Thank you. Excellent review from Brain Power. First of all, I like that this person says he shares a lot about, and he's honest about his struggles in life, but he doesn't seem like he's looking for pity. I hope you'll grant me that same grace. So like, yeah, I do share a lot about my struggles in life because I'm trying to keep it real with you and I'm trying to just be genuine and authentic. And I hope you'll also grant that, like, when I share my good shit, when I talk about the fact that I'm doing Kevin Costner's movie with a bunch of movie stars, that I'm also not looking for you to be like, oh, I'm just keeping it real, okay? I'm going to share my struggles, and if I'm going to share my struggles, I'm also going to share my victories, okay? And it's all impermanent. I'll be, you know, something will get me down in a week or two. It's transient, you know? A funny thing about this review is when you say funny TikTok, so check that out too. I don't think there's anyone that listens to this podcast that's not aware of my TikTok. Now, there are TikTok, I almost said. On my TikTok. There are plenty of people who are aware of my TikTok who are not aware of this podcast, though. And the vast majority of people who are aware of my TikTok have never heard of this podcast. So Nat's not very cool. But new have, so Nank new. Let's do another one. This other review is, I may have submitted my review accidentally, but already, but if... from Melk Swift, 5 stars, here we go. I started following Austin on Instagram and found his political points resonated with my philosophies. Recently, I began listening to his illuminating podcast with an episode on shame and how it affects compassion, both for ourselves and others. I'm a former opera singer who misses singing with every fiber of my being, but I find joy in other ways, like, all caps, roller derby. If you wouldn't mind plugging the San Fernando Valley League, we play at the Cage in North Hollywood on October 15th against the West Coast Derby Knockouts. Address, 11455 Magnolia Boulevard, North Hollywood, California, 91601. Thank you, Austin, and stay cool. Well, you heard it here, folks. You heard it here, roller derby. If you're in the North Hollywood area and you would like to check it out, October 15th at the Cage in North Hollywood, they're going to be playing the West Coast Derby Knockouts. I don't know what her team is called. She didn't say the name of her own team. So that's my criticism of this review. Very good review. But my criticism is you gave the name of the team you're playing against the West Coast Derby Knockouts, but what's your team's name? I guess just the San Fernando Valley League. Is that your team? Or is the League of San Fernando Valley? Surely your team has a name as cool as the West Coast Derby Knockouts or cooler. Anyway, if you're around October 15th and you want to go watch some roller derby in North Hollywood, go check it out, 11455 Magnolia Boulevard, 91601. Get after it. Jenny Hogan. I follow this person on Twitter because she's friends with a comedian friend of mine named Stuart Fullerton. Stuart was on my podcast, episode like 2 or 3 of my podcast called Comedy years ago. And Jenny was on my friend Stuart's podcast, and that's where I first heard of Jenny. Started following her on Twitter, think she's very funny. She wrote this article, a great article for The Cut called Staying Sober on a Dying Planet. How's that for a title? Kind of about eco-anxiety and this idea of how do you stay sober? How do you stay focused on trying to make sure that your life is fulfilling and full and good and healthy in the face of ecological disaster and climate change? And yeah, I think that it brings up a lot of themes of like fear of impermanence and fear of death and fear of uncertainty and fear of a lack of control. And I think that's all in the conversation, and I'm not going to, you know, fancy it up any more than that. Let's just do it. Okay, let's do it. I've talked long enough. Let's go. Here we go. From a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, but actually not really, in a hotel in Moab, Utah. This is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer. And today I'm talking with my new friend, Jenny Hogan, about eco-anxiety. All right, everybody. Welcome back. We got another thing. Jenny, I'm so happy to have you here. I've been following you on Twitter for probably like a year, and I think you're really, really funny. And I enjoy your daily witticisms, and I also enjoy your writing. So thanks for coming and talking with me today.
Thanks so much for having me, Archie. I'm so happy to be here. And you're a friend of Stuart's.
I'm a friend of Stuart's. Is she still doing Staying Humble with Stu? Is that still happening?
Oh, I don't know if she's still doing the podcast. She's doing a ton of stand-up, I see, on good. Instagram. But yeah, yeah.
Yeah, good. Yeah, Stuart, I knew Stuart when she was in college. And, you know, now we're on different coasts. But
so you went to college in Utah?
I went to college at a school called Weber State University in Ogden, okay. Utah, which is like 40 minutes north of where Stuart went. She went to the University of Utah, which is my football team that I root for. So what about you? Where are you from?
I'm from New York. But yes, you've been in Utah before. Yes, I'm from New York, and I lived in California for probably like 6 of the last 12 years, but no more than that, like 10 of the last 12 years. But I think I'm going to stay on the East Coast from now on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
How'd you get into like writing and comedy and stuff?
I was a data scientist in San Francisco, and I had like a lull at work, and I was really bored. And I started doing like a stand-up comedy class, which was totally random and not something I was interested in. I was never like a stand-up fan. I never would have watched it. And I just kind of got the bug. So after that, I left California and I moved back in with my parents in New York. And I have been doing, I started like pitching essays to different publications and so on after that.
That's cool. I always wonder how people do that. I'm like, when you're kind of freelance writing, like, what is that process like, the submission process? And just like, are you just writing, just hoping that, or are you developing relationships with people so that you're like, cool, I've already worked with these people before. I can, if I send them stuff, there's a good shot they'll take it, or.
Totally. Yeah. It's a mix. In the beginning, it's so, it's just kind of defeating you because you're just sending a ton of cold emails and no one ever responds. And then after that, if you have a contact at a publication, it can be easier to pitch other publications. I will say one thing that's helped a lot is Twitter. So I can like connect with a lot of journalists on Twitter. And that is definitely very good for being able to at least like know that someone will read my email. It's still hard because you have to pitch them something that's exactly what they want, which just kind of feels like a crapshoot sometimes. Like I feel like I've gotten stuff in just because they were like waiting for someone to come around with that topic and not because the pitch was like particularly good. So in that sense, it's hard, but it's definitely like a lot of fun, and it's cool to connect with different journalists.
You're very popular on Twitter, and Twitter is definitely like the writer's social media platform. It's the social media platform that I wish I was better at, because like you talked about taking like a stand-up class. I didn't know that there was such thing as a stand-up class. I thought the only way to like learn stand-up was just to get up and be bad at it for a long time and then figure out jokes. But every time I would try to do stand-up, I was like, my problem was I'm not a good joke writer. Like I'm not a good, I just like I do videos on like TikTok and Instagram and stuff, and I write them kind of on the fly. Like I have it in my head what I want to talk about, and then I just film myself saying stuff. But when I sit down to write a succinct, funny tweet, I can't do it. Like I like tweeting, but I'm not good at it. You're very good at it.
Thank you so much. I wish I were better at making videos. I will say I don't think that you can learn stand-up in a class. I think the class is kind of a gimmick. They're fun. Like that's what, when people ask about classes, I'm like, if you think it would be fun to meet people and have a good time, then you should do it, but don't expect it to like, you know, launch a stand-up career for you. You really just have to start doing it at open mics. And I would not be surprised if people teach classes on like how to be good at Twitter, but those are also for sure just a gimmick. And it's just a matter of, I mean, someone suggested that I do that, and
I was going to say, Jenny, you got to do it. You got.
I guess depending on my current level of like financial stability, I consider things like that sometimes, but not that often.
I feel like there should be a collegiate course, like creative writing's a course. They should have courses like on tweeting and like and how to write a good thread and how like what the elements of a good thread are. And like, yeah. And then, you know, you submit tweets to the teacher or to, and then everyone gives feedback on like what could go away from this tweet to make it a little bit more succinct, a little bit more clear. Cause sometimes I literally will look at tweets where I have the idea of a joke or something I want, but it's just like too clunky. There's too many words in there, and it's like, I'm fitting it within the character limit, but it's like, this, it's not reading in that way where you can hear the voice of what it is really clearly, where you can just read it and go, I know exactly the tone that I need to read this in my head. And I think you could do that class.
Thank you. My concern is that I just don't think it's ethical to teach people to be good at Twitter, because then they'll just use Twitter more. I just think like if you struggle with Twitter, that's good. You should find something more useful to do. I wish I had something more useful to do than Twitter.
You know what I like about it, though, is that it's maintaining its like initial usage as being a writer's platform. Cause you know, Instagram was like for photos. Instagram was for, so it was a great place for photographers and painters and things like people who are, do photos. And Facebook is for old people and arguments with people you went to high school with. And then there's like video platforms like YouTube and now TikTok. But Twitter was a place for little witty blurbs and news and stuff like that. And I like, cause right now, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube even, they're all trying to be TikTok. Everybody's trying to be TikTok, and everybody's totally like dissolving the thing that they did. And I kind of like that Twitter is hanging on to its Twitterness.
If anything, I think videos are doing worse on Twitter than they used to. Like, I got a lot of my early Twitter followers from stand-up videos, and I have not had a stand-up video go viral in years.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's because people have seen my stuff, or but I think that Twitter, like, used to promote videos more highly, and now they want it to be like a text platform.
Yeah. I mean, that's what got me on Twitter. I wasn't on Twitter ever, and then somebody shared one of my videos to Twitter, and it was really viral, and so I was like, well, I guess I'll join Twitter and be like, that's me in the video. And then I got most of my followers from that, and I haven't been able, in like early days I was regularly doing well with videos. It's been like over a year since I've had a video do well on Twitter.
Yeah, I don't think they want videos on there anymore. I mean, I still post my stand-up, but I feel like YouTube and Instagram. Are you on like YouTube Studio or YouTube Shorts?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the thing, is like YouTube's trying to be TikTok, and Facebook's got Facebook Reels and Instagram Reels, and everybody, you know, and I don't know. It's fine. Luckily, I can repurpose all the content, but it's like, I kind of liked when these places were their own weird little islands. And
definitely,
you know. Anyway, let's talk about this article you wrote for The Cut. I thought it was really, really great.
Thank you.
And how'd this come about for you? How'd this idea come about for you? I mean, obviously, we live in the world we live in, and the world and the planet is dying because of the shit that we're doing to it. But has this just been something that's been rattling around in your head that you wanted to talk about? Or
yeah, I think I have been thinking. So I'm sober. I'm almost 4 years sober, and I'm currently pitching a book. Thank you so much. I'm currently pitching a book on essays about sobriety. And so I was kind of thinking about, mostly they're personal essays, like entirely about my own experience, but I was thinking about what is something that could be a little more outward facing. And I think that one of the things that is like, there's sort of like two lines of thought in the sober world, where in AA they say like, one day at a time, like take it just one day, don't think about the future. And then in other places, it's a little bit more like, think about like what a wonderful life you're going to have now, or like how much better, like even though it's so impossible right now, like think about the future and how much better it's going to be. And I was definitely more in the second camp. That was kind of what I subscribed to when I was initially getting sober.
The promises. Yeah.
And I feel like it is being taken away. Not as much for me as for people who are like newly sober. I think it's just very challenging to think about anything 10 years out. And in the same way that I hear a lot of people my generation, or I'm 31. So I hear a lot of my friends say like, I'm not sure I want to have kids because I don't know what the world is going to look like in 30 years. I think that the same is true of people who are trying to just build a better life for themselves. Like it's the same idea, basically. It's whether or not you think it's worth investing in a new life, whether it's a child's life or your own life. And so that's kind of where the idea came about.
Yeah, I absolutely relate to that feeling and that idea as a 34-year-old man without kids and without any prospects to have kids. But you know, and then you have the thought of like, am I contributing to the idiocracy world where like only conservative Christian people are repopulating and multiplying, and am I contributing to the planet and the destruction of the planet coming on even faster because only people who are going to be irresponsible with resources and irresponsible with the way that they live their life are going to be grown and raised. And could I weirdly be helping by trying to raise more thoughtful, empathetic, well-educated people and bringing those people into the world? And I don't know. I know plenty of people who came from conservative households who grew into progressive adults. So who knows?
Yeah, totally. And I don't think there's like, I mean, I hear people be super judgmental about like, oh my God, how can you have kids in this climate? Or like, you know, the other hand where it's like, you don't realize how lonely you're going to be if you don't have kids now. I feel like there was like a tweet that got like a lot of shit for that. And it's like, I think either makes sense. Like, I think it's a little bit like, it's such a personal decision whether or not to have kids that it feels a little bit off to like judge what someone else is doing with it. But I know what you mean about idiocracy. I mean, I got my booster shot this morning and I was like, you know, every shot I've gotten for the COVID vaccine, I'm always like, what if the anti-vaxxers are right? And then I imagine like, what if everyone who gets vaccinated dies? And then But then when I think about that, I'm like, honestly, that does not dissuade me from getting the vaccine because I don't want to be alive when everyone else alive is an anti-vaxxer. But what if they do have to, like, you know, resettle the world, like keep kind of figure out how to keep things going? What would happen if the anti-vaxxers?
Good luck. Well, that's the weird thing. That's the thing about the conspiracy theories. It's like, wait, who are we killing here? We're killing all the obedient people. We're killing all the people who, like, believe scientists and believe authority figures and doctors. So, like, all that's left is, like, the rebels, the ones that are the free thinkers. But, like, there are no teachers left. There are no doctors left. There are no scientists left. There are no artists left. There are no, like who's in charge of this plan to kill all those people? And what is the goal here? What are they trying to do?
Yeah. And, like, I think it's also, like, the people that you look up to are all vaccinated. Like, every Fox News host is vaccinated, you know, right. They're just, like, splitting. I don't know. It is insane. But yeah, that is. Yeah.
I made a video on TikTok like a year and a half ago where I said that. I was like, I don't know who needs to hear this, but Donald Trump is vaccinated. Tucker Carlson is vaccinated. His entire staff is vaccinated. Sean Hannity is vaccinated. Everybody that works at Fox News. I just was like, I don't know, like they just are. Like, you have to be in that building. It's a union building. It's a union job. Like, everybody has to be vaccinated to go to work there. Like, so they're on TV telling you to think for yourself and to not do what you're told, but they're all vaccinated. And just, I don't know if that does anything for you, if that cues you into anything or.
Yeah. Yeah, no, totally. They're vaccinated and they want to be vaccinated. Like, even if they didn't have to be, they would, like, choose to be because they don't want to get COVID. I don't know. Yeah, it's all just insane. Yeah.
Your article, though, okay, so is about this idea of eco-anxiety. This idea of, like, you know, being a sober person, looking toward the future, trying to build a life that's worth getting sober for is something you talk about, and having this idea of, like, well, the reason I want to be sober, the reason I want to be healthy, the reason I want to exercise, eat better, all this stuff is so I can have a brighter future to look forward to, and doing all that in a world where all the science is pointing toward, well, it's all going to shit anyway. And the question kind of becomes, like, well, what's the point of staying sober? And not even just staying sober, like, what, like this idea of eco anxiety of, like, what am I doing any of this for if it's all swirling the drain, right?
Totally. And then, like, the other counter issue is that the eco anxiety makes you want to drink more. And you're right when you, like, said about, like, eating better and exercising, that it extends so far beyond substance abuse. It's just a matter of, like, what's the point of doing anything forward looking, basically? Like, what's the point of, like, investing in your relationships? Like, should we all just be, like, hedonists and, like, live in the moment because the planet is going to explode? I do think that that's, like, one of life's great challenges is, like, the interplay between living in the moment and, like, building a future, because you do want to be present and live in the moment. And that's very, like, it feels like sort of like conventional wisdom, but then it's also conventional wisdom to, like, have a 401k. And so, kind of, like, what is the, like, how do you balance those two things, and which do you prioritize if you don't know if there's going to be a planet in, like, 30 years?
Right. Exactly. It really is. It's this weird kind of philosophical paradox that we find ourselves in, because really what's under all of this, and this has been a big thing I've been talking a lot about on this podcast lately, and a big thing I've been talking a lot about with my audience on social media and stuff, and just in my own personal life, really under all of this, I think eco-anxiety and just fear in general is, like, this inability to deal with impermanence and death. It's really just fear of death. It's just, like, because, like, even if I know that in the abstract, understand that I'm going to die, that I'm not going to make it out. I think all of us that are alive right now still have this sort of, like, back pocket idea of, like, maybe they'll upload my consciousness to, like, a computer or something and I won't have to, or maybe by then they'll figure out some way to, like, regenerate your organs or something. But, like, everyone I've known up to this point has died in history. So it stands to reason that I will too, but I'm still sort of, like, not fully ready to go there and approach that and look at that. And I think that's what's under this, is, like, this intolerance of impermanence and death.
It's true. And I think that, I mean, I spoke with a lot of therapists about eco-anxiety, and some of them, and probably ones who are more likely to be quoted, are people who like understand. I mean, they all understand where the concern is coming from and they all empathize with the concern, but a lot of them were, not a lot of them, a few of them were like, there's really no scenario in which life as we know it is abolished in the next, like in our lifetimes, which I don't know if that's necessarily true. Maybe it's unlikely, but I do. Well, I don't know. I'm not, the problem with scientific research is that like, I'm, how much science do you need to know to like evaluate the efficacy of it? And then I also think, sure, for stuff like, it's like, maybe, you know, I talk about like a climate apocalypse. I don't really think that that's going to happen where like the planet explodes. I think it's more like life is just going to slowly get worse to the point where it feels like unrecognizable. And, but a lot of the, or a few of the mental health experts I spoke to said that they feel like it is people like kind of putting off, like putting anxiety they would be having anyway on the climate. Like it's not, it's that their anxiety is not based on what is actually happening with the climate or what they're actually observing. It's just like a fear of death that they've now managed to like hitch to the climate to like show that it's kind of rational. And I understand their point. I guess it was only one doctor who said this, but I understand her point. I think that at the same time, it's hard to like read the news and not have it affect your anxiety. Like it's hard to believe that someone would have the same amount of anxiety if they did not read the news, unless they kind of are letting their imaginations run wild because they don't actually know what's going on. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it definitely was like this like fear of like our lives are going to end anyway, whether or not global warming gets worse. Even if global warming did not exist, our lives would end. So it's sort of like, to what extent do we kind of just deal with that anxiety as it comes up versus trying to fight it and get rid of climate change?
Yeah. You know, I got to say, when I first started reading your article, like in the first few paragraphs, it was like setting up alarms for me. I'm a sober person too. I'm a little over 4 years, so we're in the same zone.
Yeah.
Thank you. And but initially I was like, oh, I don't know if I like this. I don't know if I like about this person talking about like, what's the point of staying sober if everything's falling, like, you know. And it just was that instant thing of like, ooh. And I really liked, the more I read, and I liked the journey it took, and I like where you land with it a lot. But like early on, like you say in that first paragraph, that for a lot of drinkers, drinking makes the present uninhabitable, and that's why they have to get sober. And I definitely don't disagree with that. I think that my drinking was making my present uninhabitable. Otherwise, I wouldn't have gotten sober. Like that is why I had to get into a program, is because that my present circumstances were not working. They were uninhabitable. But I also think that the reason I drank and used drugs is because the present was uninhabitable to me, regardless of whether I was using or not. That was my solution. Drugs and alcohol were my solution to an uninhabitable present state. The discomfort of constantly being confronted with my mortality, constantly being confronted with my shortcomings, my character defects, my imperfections. Like I had an intolerance for discomfort. And I think that the work that I'm engaged in and that you're probably engaged in now too is trying to figure out. So obviously your article talks a lot about like this eye toward the future of like, well, if I'm not building toward a better future, what am I doing? But I feel like so much of my work in sobriety has been about trying to figure out how to live life in a way where I'm tolerating discomfort, where I can accept pain, disappointment, failure, you know, where I can live with these things, where I can live with loneliness, where I can live with fear, depression. Has that come up in your life in sobriety, like the effort to confront discomfort and to be in discomfort?
Totally, yeah. I mean, and I think that that's kind of like – versus, and it sort of requires like immersing yourself in it or not escaping it. And that's like sort of another balance of like, you have to tolerate some discomfort, but also you can like put yourself in a situation where or you can like choose to avoid situations that make you less comfortable. Like, I feel like in sobriety, because it is so much harder to tolerate discomfort, there are just like things I won't do anymore. Like, I just like don't tolerate toxic people in the same way. Like, I kind of like, I feel like I used to drink to make myself more amenable to other people and like to like make it possible for me to be in situations where I would otherwise be really angry or uncomfortable. And now I kind of like avoid those situations, but it is true. Yeah. Like that, to just kind of have to like sit through the present is really just like the hardest thing in the world. And there's also, as much as it's like, you can talk about like, oh, planning for the future versus living in the present, you can't live in the future. It's like impossible. So your only option is to live in the present. So like, if it's uncomfortable, you have to just sit through it. And that to me is like one of the best things I learned in sobriety, basically just that like, a lot of the times, like if you put a constraint on your life, you have no choice but to just suffer through it. So if I say like, I'm not drinking and that's my new reality, and like something sucks, I just have to sit there and wait until it's over. Like, there's to kind of just like give myself no other option is helpful. And to understand that, like, you know, like the more I've done that, the easier it becomes, or the more I'm like, this horrible feeling is going to be over soon, or like over eventually.
Empowering though too, right? Like, there's something about it where like in our years drinking, it was just like, I do not suffer discomfort. And the second I start feeling like my day is getting a little bit too much and I'm too stressed out, I'm going to the bar and I'm going to start drinking and I'm going to let this day wash away. And for those 4 or 5 hours, I'm going to feel good, you know, before I go to bed and I wake up and it all starts over again. But like, I really had things to go to push discomfort to the periphery and not have to deal with it. But it's kind of empowering to be confronted with stuff. Like, you talk about in your article just that, you know, that eco-anxiety and this constant deluge of bad news on the social media feeds is it threatens people's sobriety and it makes people want to drink and stuff. I remember early in my sobriety, I used to fantasize about things that could happen that I could justify a relapse over. And it was like terrible. Like, I would think like, well, if my parents died, no one could be mad at me if I drank, which is like, I'm like weirdly hoping for a terrible thing to happen so that I can have an excuse to drink and no one can be mad at me about it. You know, and I would think about stuff like that. And then a couple of years into my sobriety, one of my best friends died. And I remember when that happened being like, thank God I'm sober for this. And I get to actually feel the full brunt of this. And it hurt as bad as I would have imagined it would have hurt. But I actually got to like do it, you know? And there's something when you come through that on the other side of it that you go like, okay, that thing sucked. That sucked. That didn't feel good at all. But I did it. I made it through and I was present for it and I was able to show up for other people through it. It's like cool. Like you start feeling more capable of dealing with hard things.
Totally. Yeah. It is like such a confidence builder to like think about things that you got through sober, you know, like, and just like you feel more empowered to get through future things sober like that too. Like, I remember a couple months into sobriety, I was watching Grey's Anatomy and there's, you know, Chief Weber is sober and I think his sponsor is dying and she's in the hospital and they ask her if he's an alcoholic. So they ask her if she wants pain meds and she says like, no, I'm going to be sober when I like meet my maker. And I thought that was, I mean, I like, obviously the show's a drama and I thought that was so overdramatic and that no one in real life would choose that. Like, you know, no one would be like, you know, if you're dying, you might as well, what is the point of staying sober if you're literally dying? And now, like a couple years later, I still think I would probably take the pain meds if I were dying, but I see her point and that like, once you start experiencing the world like this all the time, not just like once this is like your entire existence, like it's kind of the coolest thing to know that you don't need it for anything. And like, maybe you would not want to give that up in the moment that you were dying. But I also feel like I totally know what you mean about fantasizing about bad things happening. But weirdly for me, I have been more tempted like times when everything's going really well and I just want to like have fun, because those are the times when I'm like, oh, I could totally handle this. Like, it would not be like, if I'm on a beach with my friends, I'm like, it would not be a big deal if I had a glass of wine. Like, it would not ruin everything. Whereas like, you know, if I like, if someone died or like someone was very sick, I know that if I started, I would like go on a bender, you know?
Right.
So it like, right. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. It is actually those, the good times that you got to watch out for. Cause once you get consistent sobriety, you're like, if I go on a bad thing, it's going to get really bad, really fast. But if I go on a good thing, I could potentially trick myself for a while and keep it together and be like, look, I'm making money. I'm going to work. I'm good. You know? That Grey's Anatomy thing. I remember when I first came into the program, I was at a meeting and this guy was talking about an oral surgery that he had done, some dental surgery that he had done, and how he was in pain after it and he wasn't using any opioids or anything. And I was like in this meeting going like, that's bullshit that like your jaw is swollen and hurt and you can't like take a Percocet to not be in agony. Every person gets to do that. And this is when I was like maybe 2 or 3 weeks sober. And I just thought that I'm not going to do that. If I have to have rotator cuff surgery or something, I'm going to use whatever they'll give me to not be in pain. Cause again, I was still very close to this period of my life where I was intolerant of discomfort and pain. I've had a lifelong fear of kidney stones. Like I've always wanted, I was like, I want to make it through my whole life without ever having kidney stones. About a year ago, I got kidney stones back to back in like three, like once mm-hmm. and then again in 3 months. And it was like as bad as I always had imagined it feeling times 10. It was everything that I thought. I was like, okay, I was correct to be this scared of this pain. It does hurt as much as I thought it would hurt and more. But I went to the hospital the first time because I didn't really know what was wrong with me. And I just was like, something's really bad. We got to go to the hospital. And I figured it might be that. They did like a little MRI. It was that. But they were like, cool. So we'll just give you a morphine drip. And I was like, we can't do that. And so I was like, we got to do something else. And they gave me like strong ibuprofen, anti-inflammatories. And I did the whole thing both times without anything. And it fucking sucked. It was awful. But I don't know. I also thought the whole time, like, okay, this is as bad as I can imagine anything feeling. This is about as much pain as I can imagine being in. And I'm doing it. I'm like not passing out. It sucks, but I don't know. I think there's something about meditatively practicing a day at a time, being in discomfort. And so now with stuff like eco anxiety, the question I have, and I do have a question after that long story, is it just a bad thing? Is anxiety about stuff just a bad thing, or can it serve a purpose? Because I feel like in my life these days, like when something scares me, when I see something and it makes me feel dread, I see a news story or something, I want to ask myself, okay, my initial response to that is turn it off, look away, get away from that, hide from that, get out of the discomfort. But now I want to look at it and go, okay, what is that? What's the fear that I'm having? What's under that? How can I look at that? What utility is this serving? You know, like, do you feel like there's utility in the feeling of discomfort, looking at something and being afraid of it? Or
totally. And I think it's kind of like the idea, like, I think people need to sort of decide for themselves, like how much media they want to consume. But the idea of like shutting out the media is in some ways like a kind of privileged idea, but in some ways also like, people don't need to be on Twitter all the time if it's giving them anxiety or something. But I think it is true that there are things that we should feel bad about. And like, I heard someone once say that AA it like will help you feel bad. Like it makes it like, that's kind of the point of AA. It's not to make you feel good. It's to make it so that you can like survive feeling bad. And I think about that a lot. Like, yeah, like not every emotion is just meant to be dodged. And honestly, like we should have eco anxiety. Like it is like people should be acting on, it's an anxiety that you can act on. I spoke with a historian for the article actually, which was really interesting. He was a historian of basically like mass anxiety, which was very cool. And mm-hmm. he said that like one of the big differences now between like the, like during the Cold War, people had the same fears of like, is the whole planet going to explode? But there was nothing an individual person could do about it. And one of the differences with global warming is that we all do have a role to play. At the same time, we don't have that much of a role to play. And an individual person really can't do very much, but they can do enough that you can judge someone for not doing enough, which is sort of a bigger issue. Like it becomes easier to like kind of point fingers at our neighbors for like not recycling or eating too much meat or something. And at the same time, I think I spoke with one woman who works at a clinic in San Francisco who says that it helps her patients a lot to feel in control of their like carbon footprint and to be able to like, you know, like be tracking their plastic output and to eat less meat and stuff like that kind of gives them a sense of control that they wouldn't have when it comes to a lot of other things. So there's sort of like ups and like the anxiety is like good and bad because it is something that you have some amount of control over, like enough control to maybe feel like you're doing something good, but we all kind of know that no individual person is going to stop climate change. And that like, not only is it not going to be an individual, it's going to have to be like the government, which is also something we have control over via the way that we vote. But like, yeah, it's sort of it's a weird mix in terms of whether or not the anxiety is useful because it can compel us to act, but it might also lead us to judge others for not acting enough, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a double-edged sword there. Absolutely. And I definitely know as a person, I have panic disorder. I've had panic attacks my whole life. And it's just something that I didn't choose. I don't control. I definitely know that I have just as many stories of my panic being a problem in my life, being a hindrance, being something that prevented me from being able to get something done that I needed to get done, or being something that prevented me from connecting with a person I wanted to connect with in a certain way. Like I definitely know that it's been a hindrance, but lately in my life, I've been trying to do this reframe where I'm seeing all the ways that it's like helped me and kind of sculpted me. And I, now when it comes up, I try to go like, okay, what's the utility of this? It makes me very present. Whenever it comes up, I'm very like locked in. I can't really look at my phone when it happens. I can't really think about things that I have going on tomorrow or stuff that happened yesterday. I'm very aware of what's happening all around me. So I try to sort of lock into that and be with it. But yeah, it's absolutely a double-edged sword because also my anxiety can make it so that I lash out at people or, you know, stuff like that. So I definitely see that. But I think this fear of death thing is really interesting. That's what it keeps coming back up for me lately. This like, I was in a meeting the other night and there was a guy, an AA meeting. And there was a guy who was like in his 70s and he was sharing about how he lives alone and how he has like a pretty solitary life, but he hangs out with people at meetings and stuff. And just this guy put dread into me because I was like, oh, I don't like that. I don't like that he lives alone and that he's probably going to die somewhere by himself. But I had to look at him and go like, okay, what is that though? And what am I trying to control here? I'm trying to make sure that when I die, I have a really strong support group around me holding my hands and helping me through this really, really scary thing. And if I can somehow find a way to come to terms with recontextualizing my thoughts on death, maybe all this stuff doesn't need to be so scary or heavy.
Yeah, because I wonder with that guy if it's like, are you scared of the way he's going to die or like the way that he's living now?
Because he's living now the way I live. I live by myself. Like I live like, and so I'm like, but I'm in my 30s and I'm like, I'm still like a youngish man who, you know, but I still think like, I'm going to fix that. I'm going to get a companion. I'm going to get a family. But it's like, but why? Why do I need to fix that? What is that? What is the ultimate fear? I think it's rooted to, I don't want to be alone when I die because dying scares me.
Yeah. But you're going to die anyway. That's the thing. And like, yeah.
I could be married with kids and get in a car accident and die by myself on a highway, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And like, honestly, it might be that like, it's depressing to have people around you when you die because you're just watching them being in so much pain.
Yeah, I this is the philosophical paradox that I was talking about earlier is like, I think that a lot of our fears and our anxieties could be helped by each of us confronting our ultimate intolerance for impermanence and our fear of death. That being said, I don't want this to come off like we just need to accept that the planet's going to die and therefore we don't need to do anything about it. Because I'm also a believer that like if you get cancer, figure out if there's something you can do. Like see if like – I know it'll be hard. It'll be difficult. It's not going to feel good. Chemo sucks by all reports. Everything I've heard from people who have done it say it sucks. You're probably going to have to sacrifice some stuff. But like see if you can stay around a little bit longer. You don't have to just go like, well, got it. Like, okay, I'm going to go die now. Yeah. And I think the planet is sort of the same way. It's like, I want us to try to keep the species and the planet going as long as we can. But also, we do need to acknowledge that Earth does have an expiration date. And the human species absolutely has an expiration date. And there needs to be some acknowledgement of that, that like, I think we all want to go out and populate the cosmos and colonize different planets and stuff and just keep going in whatever form we can keep going in. But I don't think we're dealing with reality when we stay in that space, you know?
Yeah. And there's like a, definitely like a hubris to like, we're going to live forever. And honestly, it's like the people who are the most obsessed with living forever are like the most unbearable, like the Silicon Valley venture capitalists who like, think that they can avoid dying. And it's just like, yeah, I don't know. It is a very depressing kind of thought, I guess, that like, or like it's an obnoxious thought that like, we're so much like everyone has died before us and, but yet we're not going to die. Like, it's just very like, I don't know. It's like the peak, like humans being irrational, I guess.
Yeah. You wrote in that article, the future was never given or guaranteed, something like that. Like climate change just brings it into the forefront. Was this idea in your head while you were writing it, this idea of like impermanence, that like, hey, like we're trying to hang on to something that was never guaranteed to us?
Very much so. And I think like one of my current frustrations, I guess, with like the conversations that I've been having in social settings is like this idea of like judging other people's life choices, like judging someone for like when they choose to have kids or like what they're doing with their career. And I think what I don't like about that judgment is that it assumes that if you do things according to conventional wisdom, you will have a certain kind of life. And you really have no idea what kind of life you're going to have. So like you can wait until you like own a house in the suburbs to like have a child, but that doesn't mean you might do that and then find out you can't even get pregnant. You know, like anything can happen, and you might have a child before you're 100% financially stable. And then, you know, that's the impetus you need to go figure the other end out. Or you might just be also like, I feel like because the future is unstable, you can just choose to be irresponsible. Like you don't have to, not every choice has to be made for like maximizing security in some future world, because that can't, there's no way to predict what's going to happen anyway. There's no way to avoid anything bad happening. Mm-hmm. So like if you, I guess it's like, if you yourself want to live assuming that the future is predictable, if you follow a certain plan, like you can go ahead and do that. But I don't think people should judge other people for not, because the future is not guaranteed at all. And there's no like set of rules you can follow to make sure that you're going to like have a good future.
I think about this all the time. I went through a breakup last year, and like, I think about this, like one of the things that was really keeping me in that relationship again is this fear of like, I fear loneliness. I fear dying alone. I have a lot of narratives in my head of what a successful adult looks like. A successful adult is a person who's able to keep a monogamous relationship together consistently. A successful adult has a house. A successful adult has kids. There's all these mile markers. And I was raised Mormon in Utah, so that was a really strong blueprint. But it's a blueprint that exists. It's in all of our movies. It's in a lot of our books. We tell a lot of stories about that reinforce this conventional wisdom. But I kept having this idea of like, there are people who find their soulmate and it's perfect. And it's the person that they're like, that's who I was looking for. That's what I was holding out for. This person completes me in every perfect way. They laugh at all my jokes. They have a favorite meal that I make. It's perfect. They're my best friend. And they get like 5 years together and that person has a brain aneurysm and dies. And it's like, and they didn't fall apart. They didn't drift apart. They didn't decide they didn't like each other. They were totally in love, planning on having the long story of 40, 50 years together and kids and grandkids and the whole shebang. And it just didn't unfold that way. And this is just stuff I don't think we like to think about this stuff because it fills us with dread. It fills us with this. And what it really is that like, we're not in control of any of this. We're not. And I think that's what you were talking about. It's just, you can try to follow the blueprint.
Yeah. And I think that it kind of comes back to what you were saying about the kidney stones where like, the nice thing about some, like, you could have a child and your child could die, and that sounds like the worst thing in the world. And I feel like people do describe it as the worst thing in the world. But, like, if you know that you're going to be sober, then you know that you're just going to have to get through it because there's really no other option. And it is like, it's kind of nice for there to be no other option, basically. Also, I mean, you'd get through it if you were using substances too, unless you literally died. But it is nice to know that, like, it is just a thing, like sitting through pain is just a thing that you have to do. And it's a part of the human experience and that you can do things to speed it up. You can do things to like make it more comfortable, but like you come out of it when you're ready to come out of it. Not that I've lost a child, so I don't know at all what that's like, but just knowing that like the future is not certain, but when bad things come up, you will deal with them because that's the only option basically. Like, and yeah, but I think it is very true that like, I think people rush into relationships and marriages because they don't want to be alone. But I also like to a certain extent, I support people who want to rush in because I think maybe you can have a really fulfilling life with someone who's not the perfect person if you guys want the same things and that sort of thing. So like, I just think it's like, it's really like, I mean, this is sort of off topic because it's more my theory on like relationships, but I do have a current theory that like the person you have a happiest possible relationship with might not be the person you like the most or love the most. Like, I think it could be that like sometimes you love someone in a way that's really complicated and you fight a lot and you're not that happy. Whereas someone you maybe just really, really, really like and get along with really well, you can have like a very happy life with. So I think, I don't know. It's just very hard to know what is going to lead to the best possible life. And it becomes so anxiety inducing to try to like fix some image on like, this is what I'm going to do. And then this is what I'm going to get. But also like, as much as I know that on like an intellectual level, on an emotional level, like if I meet someone I like, I begin planning the next 30 years, you know, like, and I've always been that way. So.
Yeah. You're 100% right. There's no way to know what is the right choice or how to make sure that you ensure that you have the best possible life. And I think that partially that's because we also need to get rid of the illusion that like, that's what we're hunting for is like, we're trying to make choices to make sure that we have the best possible life. I kind of think that we need to get into the mindset of like, existence is a crazy phenomenon and a gift that we get to be here at all. And it's like, and just try to go, anything that happens to me, good, bad, medium, mundane, is all really cool. It's all like, it's all part of it. I need the pain. I need the suffering in order for the joy to feel as good as it feels. I need the heartbreak for the falling in love to feel so good. I need the yin and yang. I need the balance. You know, it's like.
It's no, that's really true. And I keep a gratitude journal and it's, I feel like a self-help freak when I say that, but it really helps me a lot. And so many of the things I'm grateful for are just like something being over with. So I don't have to do that again. You know, like sometimes it's like, I got off a red eye on Monday. Obviously I'm in a horrible mood. I'm exhausted because I took a red eye and I just wrote like, I'm grateful the red eye is done, you know? And it's like, I needed to like have like, even though my day sucked because I was so tired, it was like, nice to be in my apartment instead of on a plane. So like you kind of need like the thing that sucks to just be like, well, I'm not doing that thing that sucks anymore, you know? And like that sort of, it is true that, yeah, like you need, need the bad relationships to like appreciate the good relationships. And then you need like the, I mean, sometimes the good relationships end and you kind of need that to happen too, to understand that like there will be others, and there will be life in between the relationships that can also be good and bad. Also, like, I find it, like, when people talk about, like, oh, I want a relationship that, like, makes me happy, or I want a job that makes me happy, it's like, of course you do. Everyone wants that. But also, like, I am happy, sad, and angry within the span of 20 minutes every day. Like, yeah, you know, like, I can, like, definitely tell when something in my life is good or bad. Like, it's not like I'm, like, completely unaware of, like, what's toxic and what's not. But the things that are good also make me unhappy sometimes. You know, the things that are bad make me happy sometimes. Like, it's all kind of just, like, a clusterfuck, I guess.
Yes. And I love what you just said about, you know, sometimes the, even the good relationships need to end. I think that's, you know, teaching us about impermanence and teaching us about mourning good things. I'm coming to a space where I'm really enjoying mourning a lot of the things that have gone by the wayside in my life, past eras, places I lived in, chapters of my life that I'm just like, it's done. The book is closed on that. And it's this, like, it's preserved in time in the past. And it's now just something that lives in here in my head. And I mourn it, but I sort of enjoy that process now. Instead of feeling like I'm carrying this unbearable weight of sadness. Have you ever read When Things Fall Apart by Pema Chodron?
I have. I literally might have it on my bedstand, but I don't. But I have read it many times. Yeah. I mean, I love her.
So, okay, yeah. Great. Perfect. I love so many things in that book, but one of the things that has been really, really helpful to me is, and we're talking about eco-anxiety and anxiety in general, and fear of impermanence, fear of death, fear of things we don't control, fear of discomfort, fear of pain, all that stuff. I loved the analogy that she was told about pain, or no, fear, which is that this student is told by his master that he's going to confront fear in an arena, that he's going to have to fight fear the next day. And he shows up very anxious and worried and goes into this arena, and fear is this big looming hulking thing that he has to fight. And he bows to fear respectfully and says, like, you know, thank you for meeting me here. And the fear comes up to him and says, thank you for bowing to me and thank you for showing me respect. I'm going to tell you how to beat me. I'm very loud and I'm very fast and I get up really close to your face. But if you don't do what I say, you can beat me. And if you respect me. So that's been a really, ever since I read that, I've been, because I think that it's true that you can't plan your life to guarantee that you get the best possible outcomes and ever with every possible decision. But I also think that there is, for me, there's always been this thing, this thread pulling me through my life that I've trusted. Some people call it God. Some people call it higher power. Some people call it whatever the fuck they want to call it, the universe, source energy, whatever. I call it my higher self. It's like this like voice that when I'm stuck goes this way and pulls me in a certain direction that I don't really know why, and I trust it, and it usually works out fine, you know, even if there's pain or whatever. But I always sort of I used to think that same voice was the voice that was telling me to run when fear would get up in my face and would scream at me and be really loud, and I listened to it a lot. There were, for a lot of my life, I turned around and I got the hell out of Dodge when fear would get up in my face and when discomfort would be up on top of me. And lately in my life, what I really try to do is when fear comes right up in my face, I look at it and go, okay, I see you. And then I just try to not move and just sort of stand my ground and see how things unfold. And almost without fail, I wind up having like really profound, beautiful experiences. And I think this is similar to the like learning how strong you are by sitting through kidney stones, or learning about how strong you are by sitting through grief after a loved one dies or something like that. But noticing what makes you afraid. So if a story about climate change makes you afraid, noticing it, and rather than clicking away really quickly and blah, 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 and putting on your favorite song and trying to hide, just maybe see if you can sit with it and just see if, like, what is that? What's under that? Well, it makes me feel really out of control. Makes me feel like a bunch of people who aren't me made decisions that now are deciding the fate of the world that I live in and all the people that I love who live in that world. And that's frustrating. Makes me mad. Like, see if you can embrace the fear a little bit.
Totally.
I don't know. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. And I think what happens when you do that is you find like more than fear, like climate change in particular. And I didn't have this in the article because it kind of wasn't on theme, but like, to me, if I sit with it enough, there's something a little bit relaxing about a situation being entirely out of my control. Like I, to just be like, okay, it is, and climate change is not entirely out of control, as we discussed, but like almost entirely. Right. And to just be like, well, it's kind of nice. Like no matter what I do, this is how the earth might end, and I'll, it won't really have mattered that I made all those mistakes along the way. Same. I have this really pervasive fear that like, I'm not afraid of dying as much as I'm afraid of knowing that I caused my own death. Mm. Like I'm very afraid of a doctor telling me that I'm like terminally ill because of my life choices. Oh. And I think that that is not, there are some diseases that are very specifically linked to one behavior. I don't think that that's the most common thing. Like, I think that it's like, oh, it could have been because of this. It could have been genetics. It could have been something you did. It could have been some chemical you were exposed to 30 years ago, you know? So like, I don't really think like I'm going to, if I am in a situation in which a doctor tells me I'm dying, I don't think it's going to be like, here's exactly what you did wrong that caused this. But I think I really like the, if I were to die totally randomly or even learn that I'm about to die for reasons that are totally random, that to me feels almost more relaxing, which is weird. And that kind of, I get that when I like sit with eco anxiety for long enough.
Oh, how interesting. I think that's so fascinating. And I actually think I relate to that a lot. I think that like, it is more comforting for me to know that that's just like, oh, this thing just happened. There's nothing you could have done. There's nothing you could have, you didn't do anything wrong. You just, you know, like, rather than no, you made this happen. You like,
yeah,
it was actually every McDonald's fry you ate was building up this dam of cholesterol in your aorta.
Yeah.
In your aorta.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And like, I just started driving and I might stop driving now that I know, but like, it is really horrible to, it is like literally the one thing I do where I feel like I could kill somebody else. And it's just like too much for me to bear. But what you were saying about like kind of like sitting with it is like, before I drive, I remind myself that I could kill myself and other people. And like, on some level, that's a very anxious thought that might not benefit me. But on another level, it's literally true. And like, I mean, way more true than for climate change. Like, it's way more likely that I could directly hurt someone driving than that like not recycling a plastic bottle is going to cause the earth's explosion. You know, like it's like a way more direct negative outcome. And it is kind of good for me to sit with it because it changes my behavior. Like if I have that in my head, I'm not gonna like look at my phone, you know? And so like it kind of like there is a benefit to being that afraid and to really just like not trying to like fight the fear, but just like letting it kind of overtake us.
Totally. I love that. What is like what's, I mean, obviously, like you almost have 4 years at this point, it's kind of autopilot. I was going to ask, like, in the face of your own eco anxiety and your own fears for the future, your article ends in a space where you're like, well, I'm going to stay sober. I like being sober. What's keeping you sober in the face of an uncertain future and in the face of so many things that are out of your control that are very anxiety inducing?
I mean, I currently have things that I don't want to lose. And that's always been true to a certain extent, but like more true now. I also like, I'm so public about my sobriety that I almost feel like I have to keep doing it to like save face, which like I don't, you know, like if I could just not tell people online, I could just lie or I could stop using the internet, which I always fantasize about doing. So that's not, I wouldn't say that that's a main thing keeping me sober, but it definitely helps a little bit.
I have the same thing I want to say. And it's like when people talk about tradition 12, anonymity, that whole thing, I'm like, my lack of anonymity is one of the things that I think keeps me in the program.
Totally. I have like a joke about that in my stand up about like, I'd prefer something that was like Alcoholics Loud. I think that like, I also think it's just, I don't want to, I'm so afraid of, I think I could easily go on a bender if I started again, but the actual first drink, I'm like terrified because like, I used to have this like horrible drunk texting problem where I just like would get drunk and tell everybody what I thought. And I don't do that anymore, but I still have a lot of negative thoughts. So I could like, the idea of like getting drunk, I'm like, I could just like, what if it's all stored up in here and it all like comes like gushing out, you know, like the relationships that I've been in sober have gone like so much more smoothly because of no drunk texting. And I feel like, that would just, I'm in a relationship right now that could just like very easily be soured. And yeah, I just like, the effects, I think what keeps me sober now is that like, the imminent effects are so clear to me, like exactly what would happen like the very first time that I did it, instead of like, oh, maybe I could like hide this for a little while. You know, like there are other substances that I have abused that I do think I could like do for a week and, you know, be fine. And it wouldn't really have any negative effects. And maybe I'd give it up again. Maybe I'd like fall back into it. Something like Ambien, like, but alcohol, I feel like I can see exactly what would go wrong like the very first time I fell off, basically.
I see. And what I hear in that is like, I think in a roundabout way, you are rooted in the present still. Cause it's like, If it really was just like, ah, well, fuck it. I'm going to die anyway. Something's going to kill me. I might as well do the stuff I like and have fun. Mm-hmm. And who cares if people don't like me? In 100 years, no one's even going to remember that I ever existed. So like, you know, I think that there's something in us that even if we know that our name and even the idea of us is impermanent, that in several generations, the vast majority of us won't even be remembered in the consciousness of the species, we still have a desire to make this portion of our existence, whatever happens after this, who knows? Nobody knows. We don't know what kind of transformation takes place, if it's just lights out or if you transfer into some kind of different energy dimension, whatever. But I think that we all have a real desire to make the most of this. And that's what I hear in that is you're just like, because in general, my life's better this way, just right now, even if the planet's dying. And even if I'm dying, which I am. And I don't know, like, I think there's so that paradox I talked about earlier of like, okay, well, so if you come to terms with death, does that mean you give up and stop trying? And it's like, no, we still want to make our existence really special. And I think it's the same with the planet. It's like, we do need to come to terms with the fact that the planet, wasn't always in the shape that it's in right now. It formed over, you know, millions and millions of years. And there were a lot of ecological processes that made things, there's a good chance that even if humans go extinct, the planet will exist long after us, but then it's, you know, the sun will explode or something, or an asteroid will come and break the planet in half or something will happen. It has an expiration date. But just because of that doesn't mean that right now we shouldn't try to make not only the environment as healthy as we possibly can, but also like our society that we live in, to just try to make this temporary impermanent experience as lovely and delightful as we can. I don't know. I'm trying to put a positive spin on this.
No, I agree, because I think it kind of comes back to like, sitting through pain, which is that there's no other option. Like, you know, like, why wouldn't we try to make this as good as we can? Like, what's the other option? Just like be miserable when there's a way to be happy, or like watch other people living their best life and not try to do that, you know? So it feels like, yeah, like it, of course we should try to make this as good as we can, because the alternative is like choosing to be less good, basically.
Do you feel like in your personal, I hear you for sure. Do you feel like in your personal life, you've made peace with death and impermanence? Where do you feel like you're at with that?
I think I've made more peace with impermanence than with death, even though of course I know that everyone dies, but like, impermanence, I've for sure made peace with, almost like in a way where I think I'm like, I get overly annoyed when people have not, like, I just like, yeah, like when, or I think it's when people, it's unpredictability, when people don't have any awareness of that, or just the fact that nothing is predictable and nothing is permanent. One of the things that frustrates me is like, if I go somewhere with friends and it's really beautiful, and then just the conversation immediately becomes like, how are we going to get back here? Like, I want to buy a house here. Like, how are we going to, and it's like, maybe we will never come back to this one place, or like one, maybe we go to one restaurant and we have an amazing meal. And it's like, when's the next time we're going to this restaurant? And, we might never go again. And that's okay. And I feel like we should live our lives a little bit more like that. We're like, let's just enjoy this for right now without figuring out how we're going to have it again in the future. Like, we might go on a beautiful hike somewhere random and we will never be in that place again. And it's like, let's just like be here now and appreciate it and understand that maybe what's cool about it is that we never get to do it, like, or that we'll never get to do it again. And like, this is our like one chance to enjoy it. So I think like that's something I've made peace with, is like accepting that, like, you know, like anywhere I go outside of like where I live and where my close friends and family live, I might never go back. So I should just try to see what I want to see and accept that I'm not going to see everything. I'm not even going to see everything in the place that I live. So of course I'm not going to see everything in some new city.
Yes. Yeah. I love that. That's been a huge thing in my life lately, is like just wanting my life to be a series of beautiful, impermanent moments and things. Like right now, I tell you, I'm in Moab. I'm shooting this movie, and there's all these beautiful hikes, and I've been seeing sunset after beautiful sunset. And every time I look at a sunset, it's like all these moments throughout it where I'm like, oh, I just want it to stay right there. I want that cloud to stay right there. That pink, the way that it's catching that, the light is perfect, and it's constantly changing. It's just like this shifting thing. It's literally like watching sand go through your fingertips, and going on a beautiful hike, and you just see stuff that you're like, why can't I just live right here in this little part of this canyon and wake up here every day and do my work here every day? And it's not meant to, that's not the point of those things. They're not meant to be kept or to stay still. Like, it is meant to be moved through the, for it to be a thing that moves through your life as you're just sort of in this stream. And I really like leaning into that and just going, these experiences, relationships, meeting, friendships. I mean, in my life, I've had so many different chapters where like I've lived in a place and there's been a person who's like, for that chapter, is like my best friend. I see that person every single day, and then I move somewhere else and we keep up, but it's just not the same. Like that thing is over, and it was what it was, and it was beautiful. And just recognizing that in my daily life, that just things are constantly coming in and leaving, and it doesn't make them any less meaningful or less valid. But I should still try my best to appreciate them.
Yeah. There's this Lori Coleman quote I love. That's like, it's a little bit more about, I guess, like people who are kind of have their heart set on one particular ambition, but it starts with like, woe to those who get what they desire. And then it goes into like a description of someone who like finally moves into their dream house. And then all of a sudden you have nothing. What you really had was the desire to live in this house. Like, that was a lot more special than living in the house. So it's like, yeah, like it's like, I'll be like somewhere on a mountain and it's like the most beautiful place in the world. And I'll be like, oh my God, I would love to have a house here. But it's like, it wouldn't be special if I had a house there. Like, it's special to imagine being there and to like imagine getting to see it again, but it's not, it's so easy to take something for granted, like the moment you actually have it.
Impermanence is actually what makes the thing so cool.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
The temporary nature of things, the transient nature of things is actually what makes it cool.
Very much so. Yeah.
I had this thought looking at a sunset the other night. I was like, why are they so beautiful? I know that there are scientific reasons of the light going through the atmosphere at a certain angle and it creates – I get that there's that reason. But like from a metaphysical, philosophical, existential space, it's like maybe this is just the universe's way of reminding us that death is nothing to be feared, that impermanence is nothing to be feared, that – every day when this big ball of energy goes away, that's our source for light and comfort and warmth and life, and it leaves us in the dark and in the cold, it leaves in the most beautiful fashion, like in this blazing, beautiful, and every one of them is unique. It's always slightly different and slightly, and every day it does this. And you could be afraid and go, oh shit, now I'm in the dark, I'm in the cold. But it's like, put on a jacket. The cold's actually, you can tolerate it, you can handle it. And even that's impermanent, you know? And,
totally.
Yeah. And it's like it if the sky always looked the way that it does at sunset or sunrise, maybe it wouldn't be as special.
Totally, because there are like extremely beautiful flowers that are just outside your house every day. Like, I live, you know, in New York City. I can go to Central Park and see beautiful things all year round, but I don't because, or I do, but I don't appreciate them in the way I do. Like if a deer runs by and it's like, oh my God, I had not seen a deer in a year. And I get like a 1 second glimpse of the deer. Like that is so much more special.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, cool. All right. I hope that offers anybody out there who maybe had a dreadful ride through this, as we're talking about all this like scary stuff going, I don't like it. If you sat through it, first of all, congratulations. And I hope that anything there at the end maybe made it feel a little softer. What's coming up for you? You got some stand-up shows in New York that people can go see if they're over there, or anything coming up that's exciting?
I'm unfortunately going to be out of New York City for a while. So my next one in New York is in November, but I'm doing stand-up in the South. If you live in Asheville, Charleston, Bristol, Tennessee, Savannah, or Atlanta. You can find it on my Twitter. Those are, yeah, right. I'm going on a long road trip.
Cool. Cool. Yeah. That's exciting.
Yeah.
And where can people follow you on the internet?
I'm Ginny Hogan _ on Instagram and Twitter. And I'm just Ginny Hogan no _ on TikTok, but I don't TikTok a lot. I'm kind of new to it.
All right.
But it's fun. I'm getting into it. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to go follow you on TikTok and I'll
thank you so much.
Encourage your video journey.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, Ginny. I really, really appreciate you giving me the time today.
Thank you so much, Austin. This was so fun. Great. I mean, give me a lot to think about. I'm going to be thinking about this for a while. It's really cool.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for writing that great article and spending the time.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Seems like a people pleaser should be a pleasing thing to be.
But okay, so there it is. That's it. Go follow Ginny. Ginny Hogan _ on Twitter and Instagram, or just Ginny Hogan on TikTok. That article, again, if you want to check it out, is Staying Sober on a Dying Planet. If you look up Ginny Hogan and type that title into Google, you should be able to find it fairly easily. It's a good article. Good article. I suggest you read it. I was just watching a TikTok the other day about a guy making fun of people's screen names. And a lot of the things I thought were really good things to make fun of. Like, he was like, if it's just your name and a bunch of numbers, fix that. It looks messy as hell. I have no idea what's going on. He made fun of people who have like XX before their name. It's like XX, then their name, and then XX. He also had made fun of people who, like, if your name is like Ravenwolf or something like that, he was like, I know you're not as cool as you want to come off. You're a total dork. I know you are. And a lot of these criticisms I thought were very valid. But then he made fun of people who use _ in their screen name. And I took umbrage to that. He was like, get that out of there. It looks like trash. And Ginny has an _ in hers, and I have an _ in mine. As you may know, your pal _ Austin. I don't know. I kind of like that the _ separates the your pal from the Austin. I don't know. I don't know, dude. Whatever, you know. I don't think that the _ is as bad as just having a bunch of numbers. First name, bunch of numbers. And I don't think it's as bad as having, like, XX. And then your name, and then XX. I think it's okay. I think an _ is okay. I don't really have much more to add to that conversation. I think we said it, you know? Fear of death, fear of impermanence, leaning into those fears, getting comfortable with all of it. It's all in there, right? Yeah, we're good. We're good. Thanks for popping in. I don't know if there will be an episode next week. This week I had a lot of free time, a lot of free days. Next week I'm going to be shooting a lot. So I don't know if there will be a podcast episode. You know, hang tough. Hang with me. I'll be back. I'll be back in the studio soon enough, back with guests. Video version of the podcast is going on over on YouTube. You can watch this interview, the video version on YouTube if you want. Yeah. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com, looking up Austin Archer on Spotify or Apple Music, all the usual places, dude. You know the drill. Patreon.com/AustinArcher. We love our Patreon patrons. Thank you all so much. You're the best people in the world. Okay. Be nice to yourselves. Be nice to each other. Be safe out there. Love you so much. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye. Or not next week. Maybe in 2 weeks. Probably in 2 weeks. Okay, love you. Bye-bye. All this has to work out. Eventually.
eventually.